This audio download is a recording of the Left Unity meeting at the Anarchist Book Fair 2009. It's a debate between the Workers' Solidarity Movement and the Irish Socialist Network. You can listen to more audio, including more Book Fair audio, at www.wsm.ie.
Start with talking about the bigger picture in terms of the left, because it's often easy to get caught up in talking about what can we do with the existing left. Every meeting, organise a meeting for the day. But you need to take account of the bigger picture. I got a big pile of DVDs for Christmas that we spent the whole of January working through in our flat. We don't have a telly. And one of them was a complete set of Fawlty Towers, which I've never thought of as being a political show. And it's not a political show. But I only noticed this time around watching it that it's absolutely packed with references to socialism, trade union strikes, and so on. Basil Fawlty is a classic example of a kind of reactionary small business himself in the major, or giving out a bit of car strikes, reading stuff out from the paper. And he gives people to being socialists for the most bizarre reasons. And then you compare that to a more modern show, like Seamus, for example. I'm open to correction on this, so you could correct me if I'm wrong. But as far as I can remember, in the whole of the series, there wasn't a single reference to strikes, trade unions, any kind of collective action, even though Frank Gallagher's dad was a retired union official. So, if you want to sum up what's happened in the last 30 years, you couldn't really do better than that. That the actions of the workers' movement had bigger impact then in the seaside hotel resort than now today in the working class council estate. And that's the bigger picture. That's why everyone on the left really has to reckon with that there's been a total collapse of working class political organisation all over the Western world since the 1970s. People on the radical left can sometimes overlook the scale of the problems. The organisations that have either collapsed or been hollowed out from within were never the kind of organisations that we were trying to build. It's easy to say, what does it matter if the French Communist Party, for example, has lost 500,000 members in the last 25 years? It was always an authoritarian party. It always did its best to sabotage popular movements. It's easy to say, why should we care if the British Labour Party is now just a brand name that's wheeled out at election time without any real grassroots organisations? Labour never challenged the capitalist system. It always defended British imperialism. And those critical comments about those parties are all 100% correct. But they missed the point. The issue is not whether someone like Harold Wilson, the Labour Prime Minister in the 60s and 70s, was better than Tony Blair and Gordon Brown today. I think he was slightly better, but that's not really what matters. The important thing is the difference between what the Labour Party was then and what the Labour Party is now. It used to have a mass membership of trade union, community activists, the working class and the lower middle class, who identified with the goal of socialism, who wanted to see collective ownership of the means of production. And that's no longer the case. In the past, we could say that one of the main challenges for radicals and revolutionaries was to engage with people who were already active on the left, the social democratic or communist parties, who already agreed that it was necessary to change society, and to win them over to a more radical perspective and a more radical strategy. Now we have a much more difficult task ahead of us, which is to reconstruct the left, not quite from scratch, but from a much lower level than in the recent past. But this is not, I should say, it's not an argument for defeatism or throwing in the towel. If you look at the recent history of a country like Bolivia, for example, the traditional left-wing movements in Bolivia were completely decimated by political repression and economic change in the 1980s. But in the last decade, there's been a spectacular revival of popular movements representing new social constituencies. And of course, we could spend a whole meeting talking about the pros and cons and strengths and weaknesses of the Morales government in Bolivia. But one thing is clear, that government would never have come to power if it hadn't been for the eruption of popular movements over the last 10 years. Radical traditions can go into hibernation and then re-emerge in a new form when the opportunity arises. In terms of the situation right now in Europe, I think we can identify three main lines of division on the left, or what's known as the left. First of all, you have the left, which is no longer part of the left, even in the most broad, generous sense of the term. The parties that have abandoned any programme of reform, no matter how limited, and become the agents of neoliberalism. New Labour in Britain is a classic example of that. Even now, after the whole neoliberal project has ended in disaster, it's collapsing around their heads, but they still don't know how to change course. They can't change gear. They brought back Peter Mandelson, the bald people, the billionaire's friend, and put him in charge of privatising the postal service. I think that's the right way to respond to the crisis. So most of the social democratic parties in Europe would belong in that category. they're only relevant to us in the sense that many people who identify with the left still support those parties through gritted teeth because they think they're the lesser of two evils, and that's something that we have to take account of. Then you have a left which opposes neoliberalism without being anti-capitalist. They argue that we can have a different form of capitalism that will be more regulated, more egalitarian, more socially just. And that current opinion has been quite significant in French and German politics, for example, over the last few years. It's probably going to be more significant and more visible in Ireland and Britain in the aftermath of the financial crisis. Even the Irish trade union movement is taking a few very cautious steps in that direction at the moment. So for a good while to come, for several years to come, we have to assume that the majority of people who think of themselves being on the left, including the majority of activists, will be people who support the idea of a free public health service or progressive tax system or stronger rights for workers without believing that it's possible to have a socialist alternative to capitalism. So the challenge will be, one of the main challenges will be, to engage with those people, to form alliances that can lead to joint campaigning work without abandoning our own long-term perspective of a radical break with the capitalist system. Then there's the third camp on the left, the third main camp, which is the radical anti-capitalist left, which we have to recognise, first of all, is at present a minority of a minority. So the ISN have been arguing for some time that in order to increase the effectiveness of the radical left, wherever possible, it should combine its forces in a new party or alliance that can put across the socialist agenda. And I emphasise that qualification, wherever possible. Of course, one thing to talk about the need for unity in the abstract, but what does that actually mean in practice, unity on what basis? So before I talk about your situation in particular, I'll put forward two general points that we think are crucial for any new radical project. First of all, there has to be a break with the tradition of parliamentary socialism that dominated the European labour movement in the 20th century. While we don't agree with the strictly abstentionist position of many left groups, including the WSM, we totally reject the view that radical change can come about through the actions of the parliamentary elite. And I'd like to quote John McCallion on this point. John is now a member of the Scottish Socialist Party. For many years, he was a member of the British Labour Party. He was an MP for Glasgow in the House of Commons. He went on to become a member of the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh. I'm quoting John because I think it would be very easy to assume that someone who comes from a political background like that would still be utterly enthralled to the idea of parliamentary socialism. This is what he had to say about his former party. Labour, including the Labour left, has failed entirely to address the role of the British state as a bulwark for capitalism. Their unwavering faith in the parliamentary role of socialism simply blinded them to other ways of advancing workers' interests. Again and again, Labour's leadership has distanced itself from extra-parliamentary pressure as a means of forcing change. The principle of direct mass action that has swept aside despotisms across the world has remained forever anathema to the self-styled People's Party. He was talking about Labour, but you can make the same point about all the social democratic parties of Europe. That's the approach to politics that we have to break with. We need a new approach that recognises the limitations of parliamentary democracy under capitalism, that recognises the need for a new form of democracy that gives people much greater opportunities to participate in decision making. It won't be an easy task to achieve that, and it won't be particularly useful to assume that we can simply repeat the experience of the Spanish Revolution or the Russian Revolution in the early 20th century. In those countries, the institutions of parliamentary democracy were extremely weak, they had very low roots in society, and it was relatively easy to bypass those structures and launch an experiment in direct democracy based on workers' councils. Political terrain in countries like Ireland, where parliaments have existed for decades, or perhaps even for centuries, is very different. At the risk of stating the obvious, there never has been a socialist revolution in a rich industrial state with a well-established parliamentary tradition. None of us can honestly say that we know exactly what form a socialist revolution is going to take, but I think it is possible to say where we will begin. We have to start by giving priority to mass mobilisation, the kind of social movements that we've seen recently in France and in Greece and in other countries. And we can't allow the judges and the police force of a capitalist state to tell us what tactics are legitimate in those struggles. That's not to say that people should be reckless in exposing themselves to state repression, whether it takes the form of a court injunction or a baton charge. But we can say for certain, right from the start, that no radical movement will achieve its goals if it promises to respect the legal system which is designed to protect the interests of big property owners. The second point to make is about the way we organise. The model of political organisation that was embraced by most of the self-proclaimed revolutionary groups in the last century, whether they're communist or Trotskyist or other currents, has to be abandoned. The model of a party with a very rigid hierarchy of control from the top down has proved to be disastrous. Eric Hobsbawm, the famous Marxist historian who was a member of the British Communist Party from many years gave a very good description of the mentality that underpinned organisations of that type, and in some cases still does underpin it. The party, we always thought of it in capital letters, had the first, or more precisely, the only real claim on our lives. Its demands had absolute priority. We accepted its discipline and its hierarchy. We accepted the absolute obligation to follow the line it proposed to us, even when we disagreed with it, although we made heroic efforts to convince ourselves of its intellectual and political correctness in order to defend it as we were expected to. The leadership had to go through the process of repeating its case for the official line until there was no room for doubt about what we expected to vote for. The names may have changed, but the style is all too familiar. Instead, we need a model of organisation that embraces dissent and pluralism, that allows its membership to organise around different currents of opinion, that considers strong internal debate to be a sign of good health. Much of the radical left in Ireland still has to learn that lesson, but elsewhere in Europe you can find organisations that have moved decisively in the right direction. I'd include in that category the likes of the Scottish Socialist Party or the Left Bloc in Portugal. One of the best examples of the party that practices real internal democracy is the Revolutionary Communist Party, or Communist League, in France, the LCR, which is a party with real political weight in French society, which is now helping to launch a much broader initiative known as the New Anti-Capitalist Party. It's an interview in the latest edition of our paper Resistance, which you can get downstairs, with a member of the LCR describes how the organisation strikes a balance between the need for debate and the need for effective action. Olivier Besancenot, who's the best known spokesman of the LCR, their candidate in the last presidential elections in France 2 years ago, was interviewed by the New York Times a few months ago. I'd like to quote one of the things that he said during the interview. My generation is full of doubts. For me, that's not a problem. It's almost better to have doubts than certainties. We don't have a social project key in hand. We don't have a new Jerusalem where we can go live. It's not really necessary to point out the differences between that worldview and the one described by Eric Hobsbawm, which unfortunately has had so much influence on the radical left and still does in some countries. Now, I said I'd talk about the situation in Ireland, and I will. Right now, I don't think it's possible to talk about uniting the radical left in its various tendencies into a single organisation. The basis just isn't there. Mutual trust and respect between organisations is often more important than detailed political agreements, but that's precisely what's lacking at the moment. So for the time being, we need to have more modest objectives. We should talk more about left cooperation and less about left unity. We should learn how to walk before we start to run. If various groups and individuals of the radical left in this country can work together around limited campaigning goals and achieve some victories, we may get to the stage where a more ambitious form of unity is possible. But let's not insist on putting that on the table right from the start. One way or another, we have to find a way of combining our forces and maximising our influence. The gap between what we need to do and what we're capable of doing is already wide enough without sectarian fragmentation. I think there's a special responsibility for those of us who have broken with the old model of radical politics, which unfortunately doesn't include the two main Trotskyist groups in Ireland, to enter into dialogue with each other and ask how we can develop and promote an approach to campaigning work that respects the autonomy of social movements instead of trying to subordinate them to some self-appointed revolutionary vanguard. I'll finish now with another quote, and this time comes from Rosa Luxemburg, a great Polish revolutionary. 100 years ago, she summed up a dilemma that every radical movement has to confront as best as it can. On the one hand, we have the mass movement. On the other, its historic goal, located outside of existing society. On the one hand, we have the day-to-day struggle. On the other, the social revolution. Such are the terms of the dialectical contradiction through which the socialist movement makes its way. It follows that this movement can best advance by tackling the twigs in between the two dangers by which it is constantly being threatened. One is the loss of its mass character, the other, the abandonment of its goal. One is the danger of sinking back into the condition of a sect, the other, the danger of becoming a movement of bourgeois social reform. We have to take both sides of that problem very seriously and work out a strategy that can win the mass support for radical change, which is the only thing that can transform our rhetoric into reality. Thanks.
I'd like to thank Dan for that excellent contribution. And next up we have Alan from the Workers' Solidarity Movement.
Well, why can't all you socialists get together? Why not? It's a fairly reasonable question. After all, a big organisation will have far more impact than a collection of small ones. Unfortunately, the examples held up in recent years, socialist unity, include the likes of the Italian Rifondazione Comunista, which has virtually disappeared, collapsed after supporting the previous government over there. The new German Left Party has made it very clear that it's willing to join a coalition government, and on a local level has already shared power and responsibility for cutbacks. Nearer to home, the Scottish Socialist Party and George Galloway's Respect Coalition were the latest examples of socialist unity. and both ripped themselves asunder as massive egos fought to be leaders of small parties. What's interesting after all these disasters is that there's been much analysis and writing about what went wrong, but almost no discussion about what sort of socialism all this effort is in aid of. Nobody's asking the most important question, or at least very few people are: what do we actually mean by socialism? Are we talking about old Labour policies, or Stalinism, or the 57 varieties of Leninism, or libertarian socialism, or what? Should we be sympathetic to the regime in Cuba, or even to the totalitarian dynasty in North Korea? Or should we be just as opposed to them as we are to Brian Cowan or Peter Robinson? Where would freedom, workers' control, direct democracy fit into things? And even if we find agreement on these, how do we get there? What's the connection between the means we use and what we end up with? Anarchists will argue naturally that after a successful revolution, the structure in society that holds the ultimate authority should be based on direct democracy. The state apparatus, based as it is on minority class rule, cannot be used to usher in a class society and serves no function if you have a genuine classless society. As opposed to an orientation towards the state, we orient ourselves towards the mass organisations, because our conception of revolutionary change involves the self-activity of the many. Rather than promoting the primacy or the special importance of our own little organisation, we strive to popularise the essential ideas underpinning anarchism: solidarity, direct democracy, the possibility of a future socialist society. We feel that this is best achieved by a coherent group with a good deal of political agreement, a broad party with competing factions, trades coherence for size. While other socialists also engage with the mass organisations, it's not clear that they consider the self-activity of working people sufficient to bring about revolutionary change, nor that working people really have the capacity to organise the necessary institutions to rebuild society and defend against counter-revolution. For sure, many Trotskyists and others would insist that they too would support a massive increase in democratic participation in freedoms. And while this is very welcome, anarchists do perceive a contradiction between this verbal support on one hand, and on the other hand, the defence of the policies pursued by the early Bolshevik regime. Policies which saw the disbanding of workers' councils and factory committees and the banning of all non-Bolshevik working class organisations. It might have been a long time ago, but when people still defend that tradition, it does give us that there is a contradiction really between what people are saying on one hand and the sort of the general tradition they see themselves fitting into. So a bit like Dan was saying, and I suppose maybe great minds do tend to think alike, we should separate two things, left unity and left cooperation, because they aren't the same thing. If we look at the possibilities for cooperation, well, most people who regard themselves as being on the left share our opposition to the bad things in life, to wars, occupations, low pay, racism, a woefully inadequate health service, insecurity, sectarianism, racism, denial of full equality to women and gays, and all the other things that flow from the division of society into workers and bosses. When it comes to arguing for a national strike against wage cuts, promoting trade union membership, opposing the war in Iraq, or campaigning for abortion rights in Ireland, we can and do work alongside lots of people who don't share our politics. Over the years, we've worked with many, many people from all sections of the left and beyond the left in struggles to win divorce rights, to defeat the water charges, to try to build an opposition to the idea of social partnership inside our unions, to resist the rise of racism. On a more global level, WSM members have participated in international gatherings such as those sponsored by the Zapatistas in Mexico. Anarchists in Ireland have a pretty good record of working alongside others to win whatever victories are presently possible, and of using methods which encourage working class self-confidence rather than reliance on leaders, experts, professionals and personalities. Anything that makes life better for our people is good and to be welcomed. The struggles which are particularly important for us as anarchists are those which increase the confidence, the initiative, the participation, the solidarity, the egalitarian tendencies and the self-activity of our class. equally, we're not particularly interested in the sort of activity which reinforces passivity, apathy, cynicism, and reliance on others to make decisions for you. However, when it comes to the proposals for left unity, we really need to look at what's put on the table. It's almost invariably central on putting together a common platform for elections. I said it's not because anarchists have some irrational hang-up about elections. We don't. Like, and to set the record straight on this one, we've absolutely no problem with voting. Like, how do you think we make decisions ourselves? We discuss proposals, then we register how many are in favour, how many are against. Or in plain English, we vote. And we do this all the time in our own anarchist organisations, in our trade unions, in our community organisations. Anarchists want society where the division of people into rulers and ruled is ended once and for all. So we have no interest in choosing who will be our rulers. That's why we won't be running candidates in the local or general elections. It's pretty ABC for us. As we see it, you might as well ask a teetotaler if she wants a pint of Guinness or a pint of Beamish, as you might ask an anarchist who they'd be supporting in the elections in June. The electoral process involves the mass of working people relying on a few representatives to enter Parliament and do battle on our behalf. As ordinary people, our sole activity is one of voting every few years and perhaps canvassing or supporting a party through donations or turning up to a fundraiser. No real social society can come about through the good actions of a few individuals. If a few people can grant us freedom, then it stands to reason that a few people can also take that freedom away. As we see it, the failure of the left over the last century was to a large extent that it adopted the political organisation of capitalism. It promoted a system of choosing some person or party to govern the working class. Nearly 50 years ago, and you can tell how old the quote is by the unthinking use of sexist language, some socialists in Britain who had come out of the Communist Party in 1956 after the suppression of the Hungarian uprising, and some who a few years later came out of the Trotskyist social slavery, came together and formed a group called Solidarity. And in their founding documents, they put it like this: socialism is not just the common ownership and control of the means of production and distribution. It means equality, real freedom, and a radical transformation in all human relations. It is man's positive self-consciousness. It is man's understanding of his environment and himself. His domination over his work and over such social institutions as he may need to create. These are not secondary aspects which will automatically follow the expropriation of the old ruling class. On the contrary, they are essential parts of the whole process of social transformation. For without them, no genuine social transformation will have taken place. A socialist society can therefore only be built from below. Decisions concerning production and work will be taken by workers' councils composed of elected and revocable delegates. Decisions in other areas will be taken on the basis of the widest possible discussion and consultation among the people as a whole. This democratisation of society down to its very roots is what we mean by workers' power. When you're fighting against something, you need to know what that is. That's the reason. And it's exactly the same when you're fighting for something. You need to know what it is you hope to achieve. So the first task is to spell out what is meant by socialism. There won't be unity between those who have an authoritarian vision of how society should be run and those who cherish liberty. There won't be unity between those who want to change our rulers and those who want to get rid of rulers altogether. As we see it, the unity we need is of people with a common libertarian socialist objective, not the unity of minor groups which still draw their inspiration from the disastrous tradition of Bolshevism. We're happy to debate and discuss our ideas with others on the left, and we're certainly not so arrogant as to think that we know it all. We can certainly learn from others, and we will certainly continue cooperating in struggles where our class stands to gain from it. Illusions in capitalism are being shattered daily, with people losing their incomes, their occupational pensions, and their belief that the system could somehow gradually get better and better, could offer some hope. This is the time, more than ever, maybe in our lifetimes, when we need to put forward a real alternative. And to do that, we really need to be clear about what that alternative is.
Okay, I'd like to thank Adam for his contribution there. We've been out 35 minutes to go, so I'd like to open it up to the floor. And I'd like it if people introduce themselves just before they speak. So, Just in case you'd like to speak.
Okay. I was just curious that I came a little bit late. I didn't hear anybody mention People Before Profit, which I think is an interesting organisation at the moment. It's trying to create a community. I would be quite willing for your contributions. For me, there seems to be a contradiction in a lot of way out of this work on that. I have no problem working inside trade unions. I mean, I'm a trade union member. It's quite right that people should get involved in trade union activity, especially at a lower level, and grassroots level, and shop steward level. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, trade union is democratic, all democratic, and it's a constitutional war, dollar. And the trade unions are always on the lookout for anything too libertarian, too left-wing happening on a grassroots level, and they often suppress it. And yet, anarchists will continually work in that environment. I don't see them working as much in alternative, more conventional political environments, which are just as oppressive as the trade union movements, if I may put it like that. I know that's a little controversial. I don't mean to sound that anti-trade union. So for me, I think the anarchists should get involved with People Before Profit. Take them on their word. Do you really want that union? And walk in, do your stuff. If you don't like it, walk out. Sure, they're going to be putting people up for elections, but you could put anarchists in front of that. You could put things like, yeah, okay, we will put somebody up for election in our constituency, which is, say, anarchist dominated. But that person cannot be a careerist. They'll have to resign, and another person will have to step in and will take the position for going forward in elections. Because that's a libertarian idea, that's a free idea, that's an idea that might stop careerism, stop conservatism inside even the most socialist organisation. But an anarchist will end it. Now, of course, probably that would be acceptable even if you get the full property that you want. But this attitude that I think anarchists are just a little too, well, I'm an anarchist by the way, I think they're a little too, just a little too purist when it comes to conventional constitutional politics, for want of a better word, and yet a little too rosy and dreamy when it comes to trade unions politics. And I don't think there should be a dichotomy there. I think we should look at both. We should look at politics and say, listen, we're involved in virtual politics, for want of a better word, again, but we get involved in a lot of trade unions. There's no reason why we shouldn't get our hands dirty with people like People Before Profit. See if it raises a lot of good awareness, which it is. It's very, very genuine. It's all caught up in the anger of the moment as well. And we had this debate in the 70s about should we have involved, should we get the Republican movement struggling. So we got involved in stuff like HBOC, which is kind of the prisoner situation. And I think we made a good intervention there. But I think now's the time to, the late 21st century to put across, to step in and see how much we can influence left-wing people who want to get involved in the same constitutional conventional politics. Like People Before Profit. I think
Alan
should get
involved. Anybody else like to come in?
Okay, go ahead. Alan from the International Bolshevik Tendency, one of the organisations which does look to the example of the early years of the Russian Revolution. I found the presentations very interesting and was much that I would agree with. Certainly, I don't think there's any basis for a simple throwing together of the existing left organisations in Ireland, and that what is required is what was outlined, I think, by both speakers, something more like left cooperation. The working class in Ireland faces a terrible disaster, which has just started to begin, and we are going to need various forms of fight back campaigns. Action committees, solidarity committees, strike committees, and so on. And it is in the context of those bodies with limited defensive aims that you will learn to trust each other, that the different overall political programs for social change will be tested out and discussed. There will be different forms of organisation which will come out of those, leading towards something which might be called in the type of workers' councils, with it. Exactly how that will play out in Ireland is unclear. As a Leninist, I think that there will be a role for a revolutionary party within that. But once again, that will be decided on the basis of the experience of those defensive organisations and the workers' councils, which will pose more the question of power. probably is, I would come at this question from a slightly different point of view, though. That's a bit like what Alan was saying, what is the kind of socialism we're interested in? Because I think that the central question is one of political basis, of political program, rather than organisation. Organisation will flow from the degree of political common understanding that we achieve. And there are some central political questions. So the question of reform or revolution, is it possible to reform the capitalist state, or do we need to smash it and replace it with one of our own based on the organs of workers' councils and strike committees and picket lines and so on? And I think that is something which makes the people for profit project, as I understand it, a bit problematic, because what it presents is a reformist road. I don't think that we should be combining the reformist and revolutionaries. I think this is one of the key lessons that Rosa Luxemburg taught the workers' movement. This is an irreconcilable battle between reform and revolution. What we should be looking at is how the revolutionaries can work together. There's also a question of independence of the working class. I think this is going to be a very critical question in Ireland in the coming period. We already have a proposal by Sinn Féin for everybody who isn't in the big parties to get together. I'm interested in knowing what the WSM and ISN think about that proposal from Sinn Féin. I think it should be rejected, because Sinn Féin and the Greens are not parties which put the interests of the working class as their first priority. I think another question which was alluded to by Alan but is central in this is internationalism, that we have to have an internationalist perspective at the very core of our politics. So I think those three things are the kind of central questions around which revolutionaries should be discussing about the possible kind of left unity that could take place in the future time.
Anybody else like to speak?
Greg, I'm a member of Workers' Solidarity Government. I'd just like to work on come in at the point in terms of trade union activities, like, and why, as an anarchist, I would see trade union involvement and participation has been one of the sort of more important areas of work for people who are anarchists, or people who want to sort of change society or change the type of society with it. The principal reason is that a trade union, when somebody joins a trade union, they join in an organisation, even though that most of the trade unions, I totally agree with you, are at the moment owned and controlled effectively by a bureaucracy. But the trade unions come from a tradition that they're on one side of the class divide, if you like. So we have a task and a role, I think, within that, to try and win the trade unions back to be in organisations that fight for the working class. That doesn't mean, I don't believe that trade unions will become revolutionary organisations, but I do believe that it's the point at which somebody goes into work and joins the union, they're making a definite decision that they're not on the same side as the boss. Now, a lot of the time people don't even make that consciously, but the organisations and their existence is important for that reason. And as somebody who, like, over the last sort of 20 years, has been involved in my own union, which is the INTO, and, you know, most trade union meetings you go to are boring, and you go through all this bureaucracy and all the rest. But there's a forum there in which you can talk to workers about issues like social partnership, about issues like where people's interests lie, etc. That's not to say that the only focus that anarchists have is trade unions. Well, we see that it's very important. But, I mean, we would see equally important the building of struggles within communities, the building of campaigns, and real genuine, open and honest campaigns, and with real democracy in them. And I suppose that would be one reason why we would say things like people before profit, we wouldn't touch with a barge pole, because there's a political organisation controlling it effectively, which is not open, honest and democratic in its dealings, and that's the social works party. And over many, many, many years of working alongside people, you learn whether or not they can be trusted. And in very basic, simple terms, all of the people who vote profit candidates in the forthcoming election would more than likely be members of the Social Workers' Party, but that would not be under election literature. And that's a level of dishonesty that I can't see any why if people have a political objective and a political set of political beliefs, they can't stand over them. Plus the fact that I suppose that the People Who Draw Profit initiative is effectively about election activists, most of them is about election activists. What we want to try and do is use to build real genuine community organisations, community campaigns. We would have been involved in stuff like, as I said, the anti-social partnership campaigns, within the trade unions, anti-water charges, anti-racism campaigns, and at the moment are involved in loads of different areas and in loads of different unions, etc., building stuff. And sort of focusing on the Hindu strike for the 30th of March, even though we're not going to be able to trust it to carry through with that. It's important you get a massive mandate for it, and that you try and build the momentum for action, which would bring people together. But I think just on the general question of left unity, the issue really does have to boil down to what you're fighting for. That has to be, you know, the only thing you can agree on, you know, build unity around is a strategy that we are agreed on what we're fighting for. Most of the, for want of a better word, authoritarian left, they'll be on the same side as us as long as we're fighting against the current system. But when it's gone, and what's going to be replaced with? Who's going to be forced up against the wall if we have a similar situation to what happened in Russia? You know, where a particular tendency basically wiped out another. I mean, it was only the 90s to go back through the whole struggle. So if we don't build that confidence in the working class, if we don't build people's individual freedom and democracy alongside fighting for a new society, what we are going to end up with isn't in another authoritarian state at the end of the revolution.
Okay, Paul.
Hi, I'm Paul. I'm also from WSO. Just like to ask both the speakers in terms of what our vision of what we're fighting for is about, is whether socialism would include, say, for example, the slogan of nationalizing the banks. Is that part of what we're going to get to?
Extending Gregor's point about people before profit a little bit, like the question of, well, why wouldn't anarchists be in an organisation that ran some candidates and we didn't, you know? Like, if you look at stuff like the Scottish Socialist Party and those type of examples, respect as well, when people get into Parliament, they effectively have an enormous advantage over the rest of the movement in terms of their influence, their access to television, their access to the media, and their ability to decide effectively what the organisation does. And so, to me, it would be very foolish on our behalf to go into a ideological struggle that we would be so incredibly handicapped in and destined to lose. And that's just the general point. I mean, the particular point is we can't stress enough how little we trust the Socialist Workers' Party. And it's not there's no ideological ground to that. It's because over a decade we've tried to work with them in the anti-war movement, Vintax movement, and we found them to be impossible to work with because they're just dishonest. And they dominate the People Before Profit Alliance, and so, you know, I can't think of anything that I would less like to do than to sit through those meetings and just be ignored and bash my head against
the wall. You have no problem sitting through a trade union movement that's, say, dominated by a party and old-fashioned
Marxism? Yes.
Are you winning, and is anarchism winning great swathes of it?
Sorry, can we take a
look at this?
I'm not a member of the social standing.
Sorry, right?
I took the chair. Attention getting turned up. So much for that. I'm going to talk about another member of it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't join it unless I felt it's a libertarian movement.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the difference there in the trade union movement is that obviously, you know, we're not in a hugely strong position, but there is, we could conceive of a strategy where we do become very influential when there, whereas in a political thing where we have other tendencies that are monopolising the public positions, there's no winning strategy there at all.
I don't think there's, just as there isn't.
Sorry, prepare what you want to say and let's come in after check on. So just
That's okay. My point.
Gavin.
I think the critical difference between the trade union movement and my name's Gavin, from the Workers' Solidarity Movement as well. I seem to be dominating the floor right now.
Sorry about that.
But I think the critical difference is there's potential for self-activity in the trade unions. There's a potential to get people, there's leverage there. Workers have leverage, they have the strike as leverage. If, in fact, libertarian ideals became sort of a big tendency in the trade union movement, then it would be possible to ignore the bureaucracy, actually. And it has happened before where the self-activity of the workers has, like, taken root. So either the, you know, either the union bosses can go along with the workers if they feel this, you know, self-emancipatory power, or they can, the workers can actually ignore them. Now, that kind of thing cannot happen in electoral politics. It's absolutely impossible. There is no leverage. There is no self-activity. You've delegated responsibility to somebody else in such a way that you can't take it back. And that's where I see the union movement as being totally distinct and different from electoral politics.
Yes, go ahead. Just a small point on electoral tactics. Quite clearly, there is a huge danger in what the WSM comrades refer to. There is the danger that you give political confidence to the idea that it is possible to run capitalism in a decent way, because you are adding people to their parliament to run their system. But I think the question is one of political program you stand on. What the electoral process provides for revolutionaries is an opportunity to raise our political ideas. Because of the dominance of capitalist ideology, people think that politics only happens once every 5 years when there isn't election. So they start to think about politics. An intervention into the electoral process of the capitalists shouldn't be about being elected, and it shouldn't be about presenting a program like People Will For A Profit do, which is how we have a nicer capitalism. I think it is possible, including to stand candidates on this basis, for revolutionaries to stand on a revolutionary program, which says we're standing in these elections to take advantage of the electoral process, but our program is to smash the system, with varying degrees of sophistication to get that idea across. You would, in the context of standing candidates, it would be on the basis of there being real examples of what you describe as self-activity, and you'd be wanting to give those campaigns prominence in your electoral propaganda. So I'm thinking about this. Why did you intervene in the Lisbon Treaty a discussion about how the bourgeoisie should organise itself on a European level? I think you intervened in that to present your politics. I think that the opportunity for revolutionaries to intervene in the electoral process for bourgeois parliament can be done in the same way. There is an necessity to give political confidence. It depends on what politics you put forward.
James? James, just a question for Dan, just to develop something. I'm clear enough on the role of the anarchist political organisation in terms of popularising anarchist ideas and mass organisations. Just could you develop a little bit on what you see as being the role of the socialist organisation or socialist party, which is quite broad based? Is it a similar type of role? What's its orientation towards the state? Because again, anarchism is kind of clear. Orientation towards the state for obvious reasons regarding social transformation.
Okay, if nobody else has anything else to say, I'd.
Well, actually, another question just to give them something more to chew on. Can the speakers think of any, in the near future, any real opportunities for left cooperation rather than unity? Like within the WSM, we think there's pretty much left unity isn't desirable because there's enough specific differences, but we are always looking for left cooperation, ways that we can work with the socialists, because we're simply not big enough to, you know, move society on our own. So, and presumably this should be quite a germane period for left cooperation. So any thoughts from the speakers on that?
Okay, so there's a question from Paul there about the relevance of the slogan "Nationalise the banks" for a socialist organisation. So that was directed at both of you. So anyone like to go first?
Okay.
nationalise the banks, nationalise everything. On the left, historically, nationalisation has been thrown up often as if it meant the same thing as socialism. Nationalisation, state ownership, state control of a particular industry, neither a good or bad thing in the same way, you know, if you compare it to a private employer. It very much depends who, what, where and when. For instance, to nationalise the corrupt gas field, that's a quite a legitimate demand to take up the resources. Shell, huge assets there, paying absolutely no tax on it. Meantime, working people being screwed into the floor, our health service falling down around us, proposals to take more buses off the roads, the whole lot, on the basis that there isn't enough tax money. Well, it's at least one sort of saying, right, take it off those bastards. It's quite legitimate. But that doesn't mean that we somehow have a socialist gas field off bail. We merely have a change of owner, and in that context, an owner that perhaps we can put a bit more pressure on about how some of the profits are spent. But nationalisation certainly doesn't mean socialism. Otherwise, in the 60s and 70s in Britain, you had a socialist car company, British Leyland. You know, here we had a socialist electric company and a socialist post office, and you know, like a socialist education system. No, like it clearly isn't. And in terms of going forward to the and nationalise the banks, well, that's what's just happened with Anglo-Irish, isn't it? And I don't think that's particularly socialist. In terms of like post-revolutionary society or that, bigger question is, will there be banks? What is the function of a bank? Indeed, what is the function of money? Like, you know, one, a means of easily accumulating wealth, like, you know, tangible wealth. The other is a way of rationing things. Instead of having lots of vouchers or a ration book, you do it by the amount of money. If you've got lots of these vouchers called euros, you can go off and buy a luxury yacht. If you don't have them, you can't get it. In a post-revolutionary society, a lot of things that people spend money on now, that needs to be gone like immediately. Like mortgages will be cancelled straight off. Basic right, people have a roof over their head. Absolutely no reason to be paying for the rest of your life to somebody else. ESB. Again, like, you know, most people don't leave every light in the house on 24 hours a day, like, whether even when they get the pensioners and get an allowance, you know, that needs to become free. Posters, like, when you start thinking about it, there are a lot of things where very quickly you could do away with the use of money. So, no, I certainly don't think that nationalising something is a tactical question in struggle. It certainly has nothing to do with socialism. It's about a change of ownership, much like the way the guys in Waterford Glass had a preference over which of the venture capitalists would come in, because one wanted to keep nobody other than the visitor centre going, the other was prepared to keep some production going for some time. So it's like choose the best of a bad lot. They said, well, we'd sooner have the guy who's going to keep some of the jobs. Much the same. There are times when people may feel nationalisation, yes, is worth going to it, but beyond that basis, not because in itself it's a great thing. I like the thing about the Greens and Sinn Féin, that, you know, you the left. So Pather Kirby had an article last month in The Village saying much the same. Now, I don't know how he got the Greens, Sinn Féin, Labour that into left. Like, what does, again, it goes back to what does left mean, especially in terms of the Greens, because the Greens have never even claimed it. Like, you know, Sinn Féin may say we're democratic socialists. Labour may say, still, the occasional person, well, you know, we are the party that was set up and called by Connolly, you know. But the Greens, like, have never pretended to be socialists. They've never used the word. They were always neither left nor right, but screwing you. The day that the pension levy, the so-called pension levy, was announced, I got leafing the door of my area for the local Green candidate, Dan Geary, and was about pension levy. No. Biggest issue. So what was the leaflet about? How would we get two or three trees planted on the area? We should come to a meeting in the parish centre and we discuss that. And then he's having another meeting, they had another meeting last Wednesday, like, to follow on this as the, you know, the crisis gets worse and people are finding it harder and harder. This time it was about how could we have more ecologically friendly means of using electricity in our houses. It may be valid or not, but what the fuck is that sort of attitude got to do with left-wing politics, with class against class, with the attempt to create a classless society? Beyond me, Sinn Féin, like, sitting in government in the north, It's not about what they say they might do. We can see what they are doing right now. They've made it very, very clear they want to be in government in the south as well. If they can't get a United Ireland by 2016, as they were promising to many of their supporters, they at least want to be in government in both states by 2016. I suppose this is the first step forward. Now, if you're prepared to go into government with Fianna Fáil, which they said they were after the last election, like, it's not us saying it, they said it, we can see what Fianna Fáil is doing, we can see what sort of government is they're quite happy to be in. No matter how elastic you make the word socialism, you really have to stretch it to get people who believe that's the way forward in there. On the trade unions and the lack of democracy, absolutely, some unions are particularly bad, and ICTU, like, the amount of democratic control that the ordinary trade union member has over ICTU, well, you have more control over picking the winning numbers in the Euro lottery. People like, you know, what we have is a ludicrous situation where people who are essentially our paid employees, like David Bay, not elected, they're paid employees, dictate to us. And if there's any attempt to overrule them, they'd say, well, we're going off the fucking High Court. You're interfering with air conditioning, as happened in one of the teachers' unions, the ASTI, a few years ago. However, we should not be surprised that our unions are not particularly democratic at all levels. We should not be surprised at there being quite right-wing, conservative and cautious ideas there. Because that's the nature of a mass organisation. It reflects in a general way the ideas of its members. You don't join a trade union because you agree with a particular political programme. You join a trade union because you recognise to some degree or other you've got to stick together against the boss. An excellent starting point, the beginnings of class consciousness, there's us and them, but that's what it's the beginnings. As long as most trade union members are going to be voting for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the official unions and the DUP and Sinn Féin and the Greens, well then why should we be surprised if those sort of ideas are reflected within our unions? Our task as revolutionists, as socialists, is to be in there making the arguments for socialism so that we can gradually combat and defeat the conservative, cautious and pro-capitalist ideas. I've said enough. I let Dan.
Right. Start off with the what would the ISN say about Sinn Féin proposal? Well, we haven't actually discussed this in organisation, but I think we can take the liberty of saying on behalf of the ISN that we say no. Alan has already said most of what needs to be said about Sinn Féin, their conduct over the last few years on both sides of the border. It's just a mere fact. But Adams may have said at the Ardeshi a few weeks ago that the choice between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael is between Dublin or Fianna Dí, but 2 years ago they were quite their pants in the prospect of going into Dublin between Dublin. So don't really need to talk about that too much. It is worth saying that we're in the middle, because we're in the middle of a very serious economic crisis, which is probably going to get a lot worse. What we might see over the next few years is the emergence of pseudo-alternatives coming from within the political establishment. That you could say the election of Barack Obama in the States is an example of that, but Obama probably never would have been candidate of the Democratic Party if it hadn't been for the Iraq War and Hurricane Katrina. Probably wouldn't have won the election if it hadn't been for the financial crisis. So you will get mainstream pro-capitalist parties putting forward people who seem to offer more of an alternative than the usual sort. So, although you can't underestimate the capacity of both the Labour Party and Sinn Féin to shoot themselves in the foot, it's not inconceivable that they could start some kind of momentum towards a centre-left alliance in opposition to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So, in that situation, it would be all the more important for those of us who don't believe that change comes about through a parliamentary elite. To remain independent of that, to put forward an alternative both to the right wing parties and to the kind of the pseudo alternative. On nationalising the banks, right now, I think it makes sense to say that because the Irish state, the British state, the US state are going through exorbitant contortions to avoid having to take over the banks because they don't want to tread on the toes of their friends. From the banking sector, they're effectively nationalising in the sense that they're making the public responsible for all their liabilities, providing billions or even trillions of euro or dollars to bail them out. So I think it makes sense to say, for God's sake, we should take over the damn things and put them out of their misery. But again, I agree with Alan that it's important to distinguish, particularly for radical left, seems to be nationalisation and socialisation. They're two very different concepts, because you can have 100% state ownership, which exists in North Korea today, without society having one iota of control over the economy. So it's important that rather than talk about nationalisation, we should talk about socialisation, social ownership, and we should put forward the idea of democratic control and workers' self-management, which it's going to become easier now that we even have a trade union movement in Ireland, which is very conservative forces over decades, is calling for nationalisation of banks. That's become mainstream, so there's an opening there for more radical forces to put forward more radical slogans. James asked a question about what role of socialist organisation that we'd like to see would be, you know, what its orientation would be towards the state. But I think we best answer that by talking about a few concrete examples in the last few years. First of all, I would say just a general point that our understanding of what the role of political organisation is, I don't think it's too far off the tradition that the WSM identifies with, as I understand it, that it's not a case of one party, and it's usually a party of the council, appointing itself as the leadership of the works movement. And I was reading a document during the week by Arab Trotskyist from the 1970s, which was a very interesting document. I agree with a lot of things, but it was wrong when I got towards the end of it, with a sentence saying, "We are the sole historic representatives of the interests of the world of working class." And, you know, these are the kind of rhetoric that we're used to. So I think it's a much more humble understanding of political organisation, that you're there to contribute ideas, you're there to, as it were, to help people find their own voice rather than appointing yourself to speak on their behalf. So that's a general point. And with concrete examples, I'll mention a few examples from the last few years. I think his points are a valid criticism of some of the more superficial calls for left unity, but I don't think they're valid criticism of the OSM in particular. I mean, I find, for example, that socialist works party are very keen on talking about left unity, but they do it in a completely scattered but generalised way without going into the substance of it all. You know, I read a leaflet a few months ago saying, "We need new left parties like they have in France and Germany," and there's no acknowledgement there that the left parties in Germany and the new anti-capitalist party being set up in France are on a completely different political basis. Now, that's the only communista, and the left party, very briefly, I think that's the only communista, came out of a background in the Italian Communist Party, which was both a reformist party and an authoritarian party. It was a hope for a few years that it might transcend that background and become more of a positive force, but it didn't. In the end, it couldn't go beyond its roots, and its fate was sealed, basically, when they subordinated themselves to Romano Prodi and the Italian Blairites. Their experience of the government was an absolute disaster, and paved the way for a victory of Berlusconi's alliance with the ultra-right. It was just a catastrophe for the Italian left and the Italian workers' movement. The left party in Germany, I fear, will go down the same route. It comes from a similar political background, like the reformed ex-communists of the Party of Democratic Socialism, and people used to be in the Social Democratic Party. So there's a very strong orientation there towards electoral politics. As Anne said, they are in governments in Berlin and say that there, which has almost as much resources and significance as the Irish government. And they've said quite openly, their main leaders, that they would like to form a coalition with the Social Democrats at national level. So that's the kind of orientation towards the capitalist state that we would reject. Absolutely. That it should be the ABC of socialist policy at this point, is that you can't just take over the capitalist state. It doesn't matter if you have a majority in Parliament. In principle, it's conceivable that a radical party or a radical alliance could win a majority in Parliament, but what happens the next day? They call in all the heads of government departments and say, "Right, we're going to implement worker self-management." It's not really going to work. We've seen examples lately in countries like Venezuela, where you had a reforming government, which was unusually composite, came to power with a program that wasn't anti-capitalist, but it was just a reformist program. But within the first couple of years, it had people who controlled the old state, people who controlled the army trying to overthrow them, people who controlled the state oil company trying to overthrow them, and so on. And that would certainly afterwards take the government out of a more radical program. I don't want to go too far into the argument about whether or not it's a valid strategy to get involved in elections, because to be honest, we're not going to convince each other. WSM is going to have its position, the OSM is going to have its position, And there's more kind of useful things we can talk about where we put established common ground. I'll just say that, as was said with the probation here from John Battalion, that people who believe that it is a valid tactic to stand candidates for elections don't have to be people who believe that the end goal of all that is to take over the state and introduce change in the world. There is a position that we don't identify with, that you can use, to some extent, you can use that electoral process as a platform, but ultimately perhaps create a new form of democracy, to be able to create new structures. And finally, with the point about Scottish Socialist Party, which I think the OSN needs to say something about this, because well, we were very critical, for example, of the Scottish Party Alliance, we never held that up as a model. We were sympathetic with Solidarity, and actually the SSP, quite close links with them. And so I'll say just a couple of words about why I think that probably went into the crisis. First, and what are the lessons you can learn from that for our experience? First of all, I think all the people who are now in the Scottish Socialist Party say they made a mistake by inviting Socialist Workers Party and the Scottish section, the CWI, the Scottish section of the Socialist Party here, to join, because they had a kind of aspiration that, first of all, you should get all the socialists, as much as possible, you should get all socialists together in one organisation. And secondly, they were hoping that if those groups were exposed to a broad democratic party where it wasn't a narrow sectarian authoritarian organisation, then it would change their own culture of organising. That proved to be wrong. Those groups, in the end, helped organise a very destructive split in the party, and even before that, they hadn't played any kind of constructive role in the organisation. There's a constantly disruptive point scoring. So I think there's a lesson to be drawn from that. I would say the two Irish equivalents, the SWP and the Socialist Party, I wouldn't want to be in the same organisation as them, as long as they have the same organisational culture. Now, organisations can change, organisations have changed. In the case of the SSP, for example, the kind of core group of activists who set it up came from a working background in Scottish Militant Labour, which is, again, from the Militant Tendency, very orthodox, very dogmatic, Trotsky's tendency. But they went beyond that, and they did come into a very democratic way of organising. But as long as people are committed to that old side of politics, that is an obstacle to any kind of community. There has to be a way to that. Just on the point of people getting elected to Parliament, and Czech Republic referring to the SSP as an example of that, it's interesting actually that the split, one of the split between the parliamentary group and the rest of the party, it went right down to the middle of the parliamentary group. They had six members in the Scottish Parliament. One of them sided with Tommy Sheridan during the split. The other four all came to the party against them. So it wasn't simply a split between parliamentarians and activists. We had last autumn brought over Francis Kern, who was one of those members of the Scottish Parliament, to speak at a meeting talking about the experience of the SSP. And she made the point that while herself and the other tactics from that background in Scottish Labour had broken with, some of them had broken with a lot more radically and a lot more comprehensively than others, while some of the others were still pretty much committed to the old way of doing that politics. So those were all issues that led to the crisis and the split in Scottish Socialist Party. Finally, I would just say, I thought it was clear enough what I said, that we are not, some people, I agree, have been going around talking about left unity as a very abstract goal, just getting people together to say, but we're not arguing for that, we never have argued for that, we're arguing for unity on a sound political basis, and I've set out some of the ideas that will be the basis for that. And in the meantime, we should talk about left cooperation on the left unity. So left unity isn't on the agenda in Ireland. It wouldn't serve the constructive goal if we set up I think the United Party tomorrow, it would probably fragment within 6 months or at most within a couple of years. So we should talk about left cooperation. Chega was asking what kind of concrete things we could do there. I'm not sure if I can say an immediate campaign that we can work together on, but I'd say this, that even those of us who believe that it is a valid tactic to run candidates for elections, understand that the most important day that's coming up over the next couple of months, it's not going to be the day of the local European elections, it's going to be the day of the one-day national strike if it goes ahead. And so let's say that everything goes well, the strike's success, it's not called off at the last minute so that trade union leadership can go into talks, that results in nothing positive. and there's some kind of momentum coming out of Geneva. Within that movement, the radical left is still going to be very small. You know, effectively, the demonstration we had 2 weeks ago, it was organised by the trade union leadership. Let's be honest, none of us has the capacity, even if we all work together, we don't have the capacity to bring 150,000 people onto the streets of Dublin. And so it's going to be a challenge because, well, as long as the trade union leadership is in charge of that movement, they don't have any kind of radical agenda, and it's going to be a need for radical socialists to intervene in that. So I'd say there's two levels to that, that everyone would be called radical left, and that would include the Socialist Party, SNPP, OESM, myself, should try to the greatest possible extent to work together and work across some kind of common agenda. But then within that, those of us who are broken with the old style of left politics, as I described it, who believe that you have to respect the autonomy of social movements instead of trying to subordinate themselves, subordinate them to a party that's appointed itself as the leadership, then we should be talking about how we can work together and argue for a distinctive approach to campaigning work.
Okay, I'd like to thank both Dan and Alan for their talk about the role of the socialist organisation and the difference between left cooperation and left unity. So thank you all for coming.
This audio download is a recording of the Left Unity meeting at the Anarchist Book Fair 2009. It's a debate between the Workers' Solidarity Movement and the Irish Socialist Network. You can listen to more audio, including more Book Fair audio, at www.wsm.ie.